you have at the Met access to a collection that makes, you know, JP Morgan or anyone else's collection that's just the table scraps of the great public collections. You know, it belongs to all of us. And I do think that it is something, you know, to be proud of.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to Cambridge Forum. I'm Mary Stack. Today we're going to fence with some of the larger, more difficult to quantify considerations in life. I refer, of course, to the arts and humanities. Should we care about the past, and what good are the arts? We've got two wonderful guests with us today. Martin Puchner, a Harvard humanities professor, has written a brand new book, Culture, The Story of Us from Cave Art to K-Pop. And Patrick Bringley worked as a museum guard at the Museum of Metropolitan Art in New York for 10 years before leaving to write a book about his experiences. The book is called All the Beauty in the World. So what do places like the Met give us individually and collective? Going back to this thing, you can't quantify a value such as pleasure or enlightenment or joy. What do they give us, and what would we lose? I'll ask you first, Patrick, and then we'll come back to you, Martin, if that was gone from your perspective, being there day after day after day, seeing how many thousands of people are walking around.
Yeah, it's interesting you said individually and collectively. And I do think the museum has both of those components. I mean, collectively, it's this big sort of bastion of culture where all of New York City or all of Boston or something can show up and engage with this new exhibition that's going on. And it sort of is, I don't know, it's a bit of permanence in the city. But people also have their own private relationships with museums. It's unlike other kinds of culture because, you know, the book I wrote or the book Martin wrote, it sort of takes you on a linear journey. It grabs you by the nose and we're telling them something and then they're out at the other end of it. And same with a film or same with a play. Whereas a museum, you just show up, you're self-directed, you're on your own. You can spend 2 minutes looking at that painting or you could spend an hour. You can decide that this wing is for you or that wing is for you. And you build a relationship to this place and you explore in this place. And the nature of art is that you can have very direct experiences. You know, the Greeks, when they met a god, they called that an epiphany, when you saw a god face to face. And in a museum, you're seeing stone and bronze gods, but you can still feel the beauty and the power and the presence. And that's something very different than reading a book where people are just telling you about something. Not that books can't make you feel power and presence as well. But if you were to lose that, you would just lose this place of exploration, of sort of intellectual and spiritual and soul exploration that are kind of temples in so many of our cities.
What would you say, Martin?
Yeah, no, that's beautifully said.
That's beautiful.
You know, when you ask about loss, in my mind, I thought, okay, what if it's gone? And I remembered that, you know, if you look at cultural history, the norm is that things get lost. So much gets lost constantly. This is why I emphasize this, or some of the institutions like the caves and temples and so on and so forth, and the strange mechanism that the cruel, you know, sort of Darwinian struggle from what gets preserved and how much is lost always. And I think once that really sunk in, and then these rare moments when something is recovered, sometimes after hundreds or thousands of years, these rare moments when, you know, like the volcano buries Pompeii under a coat of ash, but also preserves it. I became obsessed with these time, kind of almost like time capsules, all the Chauvet caves that get closed up, and that's why they survive. So these rare moments when something from the, especially the distant past, sort of makes it to us, and then perhaps into a museum like the Met or other museums or other places of preservation, a library or other contexts. And so, you know, this in some sense now, when I think about culture, I constantly play in my mind these scenarios of loss and how much gets lost. And it creates such a, I don't know, feeling of gratitude for these, as I said, rare pieces that survive, and how much accident, but also deliberate preservation had to go into each of these pieces being preserved. You know, for example, I have a chapter about a South Asian statue, a tiny statue in Pompeii that was preserved. You know, if not for the volcano, we wouldn't know that. And I try to follow the path of that statue from what is today Afghanistan, all the way to Rome, the Roman Empire. And so these rare moments are really amazing. And it just turned me into a champion of preservation, but also of circulation. So, you know, the Met is such a rich institution. Of course, it's great in New York where lots of people come and, you know, lots of tourists, but there are of course hard questions about museums and how objects circulate and where these objects are. And so I think that you know, their museums are confronted with hard questions about that, and rightly so.
Okay, we've got tons of questions coming in from people here.
Let's do it.
Somebody says, what about the pure pleasure that study of literature, history, and philosophy have? I graduated from Haverford College, the philosophy degree, 50 years ago. One of my professors, in an introduction to a book of his essays, wrote of this, the pleasure and joy of thinking as what attracted him to the study of philosophy to begin with. Then along the way, we discover that knowing how to think is useful in the world, almost whatever we end up doing. So I think that is an amazing point. You can't always see the direct line from A to B of this results in that. It's an enrichment process. And somebody asked you to define cultural sophistication. What would that be, Martin? Have you got a definition for that?
It's not a term I'm particularly invested in, but I love what you just relayed the first question as being. And I think that's so true, that you have to be excited by something as a student, and then you throw yourself into it and you try to understand it and you try to be good at it. And that has a lot of sort of knock-on benefits. You're more engaged, you learn more, and that then also spills over into maybe other careers. But you've done this thing out of an initial attraction. And so I sometimes try to say this to students, you know, who are worried about this, rightly so, that if they're passionate about something, they're much more likely to be very good at it and get much more out of it. And I think, you know, has all kinds of indirect benefits that can be also very practical. So cultural sophistication, I use this term cultural intelligence. I think it's important to understand culture, and especially if you don't have the, you know, the privilege to travel a lot, which, you know, some students may, others may not. It's important to, in some other ways, to get some sense of, you know, the enormous varieties of human lives that Patrick also talked so movingly about. And I think humanities provided, and the varieties in the past is a foreign country. And I think that for me is more important than sophistication in the sense of, you know, being able to rattle off quotes or something. I mean, I'm sure the person who asked the question didn't mean it like that, but the experience of cultural difference, I think, is very important. So that's something I care about.
Somebody had written in, the humanities are what gives us the perspective required to transcend our roles as manipulated consumers. So that's a completely different tack, but it's a very valid one, that it's allowing us to develop parts of ourselves that aren't directly linked with us being a purchaser. We're just being an experiential animal without there being an end product necessarily. And it's somewhat a protection, would you say? You said it frees people up. You had a great definition when we were talking, Patrick, about it makes you a freer thinker, the humanities.
Sure. I mean, I think it's not only, you know, not being manipulated as a consumer or something, but just not be so narrow-minded about anything in particular. You know, oftentimes there seems to be one conversation going on Twitter or whatever, and everyone is thinking about this one hot button issue. And all you have to do is crack open books or go to a museum to remember, oh my God, the world is enormous. It's absolutely enormous. And there are all different people who are thinking all different things in all different styles. And there are whales in the ocean and there are stars in the firmament. And there is just so much going on in this universe. And it is not true that, you know, the only thing that's interesting right now is this conversation going on the discourse or whatever. So I think it's always a good corrective when you're too in your own head, when you're too in the head of whatever small-minded debate is going on, to just read a book, you know, see it's a big old world.
Somebody's asking a question here. Well, actually, there's a lot of questions, but this last person said, what are your thoughts regarding the current notion on some universities and colleges completely eliminating their arts and humanities, social science departments, and fully focusing just on STEM, business, and law?
You know, you have to look what these universities are actually doing. Some are, it's true, eliminating departments, but they're not eliminating courses. Some are consolidating departments, and that, you know, that is a complicated process. I actually think that sometimes, because I'm so become so anti-specialized, hyper-specialization in teaching, that it can actually be better for humanists to have to teach a little more broadly and across the curriculum. And I've also become a big fan of more, you know, general education courses. This is what I now mostly teach, not for humanist specialists. So I wouldn't say just because a university closes down a department that necessarily, you know, that they are necessarily anti these courses. I don't know. It's also true that some universities are not supporting the humanities enough, but I, you know, because I feel like I can only, we humanists can only change what we do. We can't change the world. I think that if we do a better job at attracting students and making a compelling case, university administrators will follow, because you know what? We are cheap, we humanists. So in some sense, I think university administrators would love to, you know, have us teach lots of students the way we did in the 70s. So yeah, maybe I'm too much blaming ourselves all the time, but that's just sort of how I think. It's always easy to blame someone else.
You're listening to Why Do We Need the Humanities with Martin Puchner, author of Culture, The Story of Us from Cave Art to K-Pop, in conversation with Patrick Bringley, ex-museum guard at the Met, and author of All the Beauty in the World. Okay, another question. I love the embrace of humanities and taking undergrad courses in these fields, but I would say that humanities are not all about beauty and, as Patrick put it, about being uplifted by the works of humanity. Much of it is very difficult, conflicted, does not always make the student happy. I am currently teaching Uncle Tom's Cabin. The responses there are not of uplift. It's a complex experience to be engaged in the artifacts and expressions of humanity. Good point. But it's definitely enriching all the same. It may not always be uplifting, but you come away with a better understanding of things. I personally would find it very difficult, Patrick, to stand on one spot for, I don't know, 2 hours or whatever it is you have to do before you move from gallery to gallery. And it's rather controlled. I don't know how much you say you've got in being stuck where you're stuck. I would have thought not too much. So how did you get over the boredom factor and the physical fatigue?
You stretch a lot. You know, it's funny. I was never particularly bored. I mean, of course, some days, but you have a very different experience with time when you have an 8 or 12 hour day to just be standing and looking around. I think if you have, you know, 45 minutes to kill, it can feel interminable. But if you have 12 hours to kill, you just have to declare a truce because you know that you're not going to kill it. So you sort of learn how to just exist in that space, and you learn how to use the resources you have. And, you know, a guard told me, when you get bored of the people, you look at the art. When you get bored of the art, you look at the people. You're sort of mining what there is in your own head. You're talking to people, shooting the breeze, but it's almost not something that you can analogize to, you know, oh, if I had to stand there for 1 hour, I would be bored. Well, of course you would be. But if it was 12 hours, it's a little different. You kind of enter a different state. The wavelengths are longer.
And what's the best, one of the best things that happened while you were doing the 10-year stint?
One of the best things? Oh, man. Well, I'll tell you that one of my favorite, one of my good friends there, he's a guard. I call him Joseph in the book. I changed names. But he's a wonderful man, and he's from West Africa. And he just retired. And we were just having a retirement dinner for him. And he is building in his house. He's building himself a house in Ghana, where he's going to retire half the year. And he's showing us pictures of this house in Ghana. And I say, Vincent, that's the Moon Gate from the Chinese Scholars Garden at the Met. And his favorite gallery at the Met is the Astor Court, the Chinese Scholars Garden. And, you know, so here's a guy from Chicago and a guy from West Africa talking about a Chinese Scholars Garden in New York City that he's building in Ghana. And that's just not even, you know, that's the sort of thing that happens all the time. It doesn't even seem that odd, that sort of a experience. So I would say that recent experience was something that hit me here.
That talk about opening up your mind and your world and your cultures. That's a perfect example, isn't it? It transcends everything, the building, your personalities, everything. That's wonderful. So back to these questions again. What is the future of humanities if continuing on the idea of no specialties?
Yeah, well, I should reiterate what Martin says. I don't have anything against specialists. I mean, of course, specialists are very important. And I don't begrudge anyone who spends, you know, 20 years of their life trying to figure out, you know, who Velázquez's assistants are or something. Like, that's important. That has value too. What the curators have value. I think what we're both saying is that there's only so many people who have that kind of mind. And for the humanities to thrive, there needs to be larger consideration that many people are generalists. Many people are interested amateurs. Many people are, you know, interested in using this stuff as sort of fuel for something else they're doing, and that we should kind of open the door for all those things.
Okay. So here's a good question. Aren't arts and humanities the way we connect our minds and our hearts to the people who lived so long ago to learn they had the same thoughts and feelings we do? Isn't it comforting and a source of wonder? Wow, that's wonderful. Yeah,
I would say absolutely. I mean, of course, people who lived a long time ago are also strange. They're both. They're strange and they're relatable. And, you know, if you're in the Met and you walk up to a Greek statue of the Koros made in the Archaic Age or something, I mean, one thing you will notice is that, you know, that guy's body looks more or less like your body does underneath your clothes. And, you know, this was made by a pair of human hands, and you can kind of see that the human hands made it at that time somewhat awkwardly because they were just kind of figuring out how to depict the nude body in, you know, that part of the Mediterranean at that time. And all of that is very relatable. And, you know, the sun shined in ancient Athens and it's shining today. Like, you know, it wasn't that long in the span of things. But also I will put in the point that one of the reasons to study this stuff too is to come across profound strangeness, where you're like, wow, the ancient Egyptians really thought about death so differently than the way that I think about death. And you can evaluate what you think of, you know, what conclusions, but you also have to realize they had this cultural edifice that shaped them that is so different than the cultural edifice that shapes us. And, that is too enriching and makes you have a larger perspective on what's possible in the world.
Yeah, I would say the same thing. I mean, when I immerse myself in a distant period or interact with an artwork or a text, I'm constantly thrown back between familiarity and indifference. Because it's true, these were humans, they were exactly, you know, like us, their DNA was exactly like us. And I think we sometimes overemphasize difference, but then the next moment there is something strange that happens. So I find the perhaps it's the going back and forth between those positions that is ultimately the most enriching for me, the most My favorite example of similarity are these fragments from Egyptian scribal schools, where you have, like, you know, students complaining about their teachers. My teacher beat me. My teacher, you know, is too hard on me, doesn't understand, you know, how difficult it is to a student. And then you have teachers, and this is from like 3,000 years ago, teachers saying, you know, this generation of students no longer really cares about the arts and humanities. I mean, they don't say arts and humanities, but it's essentially this, you know. And so you'd be like, oh my God, this could be written today, you know. So that.
Patrick. This woman, Elizabeth Wallace, asked you a question. I took the Museum Hack boot camp, discovered the Met and me in the Met in a very unusual, unique way. If you're familiar with Museum Hack, do you think it would be a good way for more students to discover the Met by creating their own tours?
Sure. Yeah, I'm familiar with Museum Hack. I think the pandemic might have killed them off. I don't know. But yes, I'm giving tours of the Met too these days, and walking people through the Met and doing it from a sort of perspective, and having sort of a story to tell and a narrative to thread through as you are walking amongst the galleries is, of course, a wonderful way to do it, because it sort of incorporates storytelling and it's people feel like they have a frame of reference for coming to the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. So yeah, I found that to be a very successful way of engaging people for sure.
Okay, another question. Could our speakers comment on the relation of money, profit, to the enjoyment and appreciation of cultural phenomena? Do we have to try and ignore it?
I certainly don't think we should ignore it. I mean, there's a lot of money always involved. It's not just money. I mean, it's interesting, especially if you look at ancient cultures, any act of preserving something required enormous, you know, financial or resources, which to copy manuscripts, to preserve something. So I think there's always, societies make value judgment and decide what is valuable and what is not valuable. And, you know, in our capitalist economy, that's also the case. So yeah, I think money absolutely plays a role, especially if you start to, you know, as I try to do, trace, to come back to the South Asian statue, it to Rome. Rome was buying all the stuff from the East, so much so that there's actually a trade imbalance between Rome and the East. All these Roman coins are found in India and in Afghanistan and so on and so forth. So, you know, trade.
I wonder if she was referring to access to culture, like who can actually avail themselves of culture, you know, entry to spaces. I don't know if she means that. I don't know if the Met is free on certain nights, like MoMA.
Yeah. So the Met, you can pay whatever you will if you're a New Yorker. It used to be anyone can pay whatever they will. And unfortunately, that's done away with. But I do tell people, you know, people ask you as a guard, you know, how much is this? How much is this worth? And you can't answer that question, and not just for sort of a Pollyanna reason, like, oh, this is priceless. But it's because the reason why things that go onto the art market have these crazy inflated prices is because most stuff does not come onto the art market because it's in public collections. It, you know, it belongs to all of us. And you, even if you have to pay your, you know, $30 to get into the Met, you have at the Met access to a collection that makes, you know, JP Morgan or anyone else's collection that's just the table scraps of the great public collections. And I do think that it is something, you know, to be proud of. That one of my favorite guards, I asked him why he became a guard at the Met. And he said, well, the only thing I've ever wanted to be is an independently wealthy patron of the arts, and this comes closest. And I think we could all kind of feel that way sometimes. Go into that museum like you own the place, and you do own the place. It's all right there for you to look at. The trustees don't get to touch the art, just like you don't get to, believe me.
Okay, last question. How would you convince students who are already taking humanities courses, but perhaps loathe key elements to be more receptive to these elements, such as poetry, art, or even the act of reading? Running into many intelligent people now who hate to read, how to approach making humanities relevant to someone already dealing with the field? Gosh, that's a big question. How do we make it more relevant? I don't know.
I'm trying to fully understand the question. So, you know, so students who don't want to read, there are lots of other arts and humanities have to read always, but I don't quite know what that means. But, you know, there are lots of visual humanities. I have a background in theater. You know, that's, you know, I'm always struck by the fact that the students who gravitate towards theater and dance aren't necessarily as, you know, big readers or exercise very other faculties and activities in doing the arts. So I think that to suggest that, you know, you have to be a big, I, for example, was not a big reader as a teenager at all. I came to the humanities through philosophy. Yes, that's reading, but only then sort of gravitated into literature. So I don't think that, you know, the humanities are for the people who have always been big readers necessarily. I wouldn't restrict, I restrict it to that. There's so much to be discovered, you know, arts, cultures, different people, different times.
A last comment from you, Patrick, on that. Have you got anything to add to that mix?
Sure. I mean, I think it goes back to what we've been saying, that people are different, you know? I mean, there's not a one size fits all way to engage with a student and try to get them to love something or put their heart into it or engage with it. The person who said it's not all uplifting, that's absolutely true. I mean, maybe you're trying to get someone to struggle with something, to empathize with something. And, you know, different strategies are going to have to be employed with different people, because somebody might be intensely interested in thick tomes. And some people, like Martin said, might be transported sitting in a theater and the lights go down and the lights go up. And that, you know, that is the magic for them. And it's not so much being in a quiet room with a book. And of course, the humanities isn't going to be for everyone as a major. So it's always going to be a fight. You're always going to have to find the different angles.
Well, there's two points before we close that people have made here. I'd love you to make the point that humanities will help us get along with each other and collaborate in both politics and STEM. Good point, point well taken. Perhaps we are fretting too much about undergraduates. Learning is lifelong. I loved my philosophy courses as an undergrad, but it was not realistic majoring. After retiring as a physician scientist, I've been taking many courses, all in the humanities, in adult education. Many of my classmates are taking these courses for the same reasons, to enrich our lives and make up for lost time training for or focusing on our careers. The memories of my undergrad humanities professors continue to inspire.
Yes, I think that's a wonderful point. It's a wonderful point that, you know, I found myself, I mentioned I was friends with that guard who was close to retirement. I was very frequently friends with the old timers because, you know, you reach a point in life where you've experienced things and you know who you are, but also maybe your ego has been, you know, brushed away by various hardships you've had in your life, and you're open to learning, and you're, you know, you don't have any pretensions, and those people are obviously the most wonderful students of things like the arts in a museum, because they can connect it with things in their life. They have texture to the way that they relate to these things. And no, that's a wonderful point, that it's not just undergraduates we should be worrying about.
So I want to thank Martin Puchner, author of Culture, The Story of Us from Cave Art to K-Pop, in conversation with Patrick Brindley, ex-museum guard at the Met, and author of All the Beauty in the World. Cambridge Forum is made possible by the generosity of Herbert and Dorothy Vetter, the Lowell Institute, the Mass Cultural Council, Cambridge Community Foundation, and you. You can step up and donate via the website, cambridgeforum.org. Thanks, everybody, for joining us today and enriching the discussion. And I hope to see you all soon.